You guys started this crap. Now I have to finish it.
Does he have a subpoena?
Hoover asks. The bailiff hands over some paperwork, and Hoover and Kaufman scan it quickly.
It's not a subpoena, Kaufman says. It's sort of a notice from Judge Sampson. Thought he was dead. He has no right to notify me to be present for a hearing of any kind.
He's been off his rocker for 20 years, Hoover says, somewhat relieved.
I ain't going. We're in the middle of a trial here.
He's not wrong about Judge Sampson. If the lawyers could vote for the craziest federal judge in the land, Arnie Sampson would win in a landslide. But he's my crazy friend, and he's freed me from jail before. Kaufman says to the bailiff,
Tell the marshal to get lost. If he starts trouble, tell the sheriff to arrest him. That'll really piss him off, won't it? The sheriff arresting a marshal. Ha! Bet that's never happened before. Anyway,
we're not leaving. We have a trial to resume here.
Why do you run to federal court? Hoover asks me in all seriousness.
Because I don't like being in jail. What kind of stupid question is that?
The bailiff leaves and Kaufman says,
I'm vacating the contempt order, okay, Mr. Rudd? I figure one night in the slammer is enough for your behavior.
I say, Well, it's certainly enough for a mistrial or a reversal.
Let's not argue that, Kaufman says.
Can we proceed?
You're the judge. What about the hearing in federal court?
Are you asking me for legal advice? I fire back.
Hell no!
Ignore the notice at your own risk. Hell, Judge Sampson might throw the both of you in jail for a night or two. Wouldn't that be funny?
Chapter 12. We eventually make it back to the courtroom, and it takes some time to get everyone settled. When the jury is brought in, I refuse to look at them. By now they all know I spent the night in jail, and I'm sure they're curious about how I survived. So I give them nothing. Judge Kaufman apologizes for the delays and says it's time to get to work. He looks at Hoover, who stands and says,
Your Honor, the state rests.
This is an amateurish ploy designed to make my life even more miserable. I rise and angrily say,
Your Honor, he could have told me this yesterday or even this morning.
Call your first witness, Kaufman barks.
I'm not ready. I have some motions, on the record.
He has no choice but to excuse the jury. We spend the next 2 hours haggling over whether or not the state has presented enough proof to keep going. I repeat the same arguments. Kaufman makes the same rulings. It's all for the record. My first witness is a scraggly, troubled kid who looks remarkably similar to my client. His first name is Wilson. He's 15 years old, a dropout, a druggie, a kid who's basically homeless, though an aunt allows him to sleep in the garage whenever he's sick.
And he's our star witness.
The Fentress girls went missing around 4 on a Wednesday afternoon. They left school on their bikes but never made it home. A search began around 6 and intensified as the hours passed. By midnight, the entire town was in a panic, and everyone was outside with a flashlight. Their bodies were found in the polluted pond around noon the following day. I have 6 witnesses, Wilson and 5 others, who will testify that they were with Gardy on that Wednesday afternoon from around 2 until dark. They were at a place called The Pit, an abandoned gravel pit in the middle of some dense woods south of town. It's a secluded hideout for truants, runaways, homeless kids, druggies, petty felons, and drunks. It attracts a few older deadbeats, but for the most part it's a haven for the kids nobody wants. They sleep under lean-tos, share their stolen food, drink their stolen booze, take drugs I've never heard of, engage in random sex, and in general waste away the days while sliding closer to either death or incarceration. Gardy was there when someone else abducted and murdered the Fentress girls. So we have an alibi. My client's whereabouts can be vouched for. Or can it? By the time Wilson takes the stand and is sworn in, the jurors are suspicious. For the occasion, he's wearing what he always wears, grimy jeans with lots of holes, battered combat boots, a green T-shirt proclaiming the greatness of some acid rock band, and a smart purple bandana looped around his neck. His scalp is skinned above the ears and yields to a bright orange mohawk roaring down the center. He's displaying the obligatory collection of tattoos, earrings, and piercings. Because he's just a kid without a clue and is now being dragged into such a formal setting, he instantly retreats behind a smirk that makes you want to slap him. "Just be normal," I told him. Sadly, he is. I wouldn't believe a word he says, though he's telling the truth. As rehearsed, we walk through that Wednesday afternoon. Hoover annihilates him on cross-examination. "You're 15 years old, son. Why were you not in school?" "Smoking dope, huh? Along with your pal here? That's what you're telling these jurors?" "Drinking and drugging. Just a bunch of deadbeats, right?" Wilson does a lousy job of denying this. After 15 minutes of abuse, Wilson is disoriented, afraid he might be charged with some crime. Hoover hammers away, a bully on the playground. But because Hoover is not too bright, he goes too far. He's got Wilson on the ropes and is drawing blood with each question. He's grilling him about dates. How can he be certain it was that Wednesday back in March? "You kids keep a calendar out there at the pit?" Loudly. "You have no idea what Wednesday you're talking about, do you?" "Yes, sir," Wilson says politely for the first time. "How?" "Because the police came out there, said they were looking for two little girls. That was the day, and Gardy had been there all afternoon." For a kid without a brain, Wilson delivers this perfectly, just like we practiced. Evidently, when there is a crime in Milo, slightly more serious than littering, the police rush out to the pit and make accusations. Harass the usual suspects. It's about 3 miles from the pond where the Fentress girls were found. It's blatantly obvious none of the regulars at the pit have any means of transportation other than their feet, yet the police routinely show up and throw around their considerable weight. Gardy says he remembers the cops asking about the missing girls. The cops, of course, do not remember seeing Gardy at the pit. None of this matters. This jury is not about to believe a word, Wilson says. Next, I call a witness with even less credibility. They call her Lolo, and the poor child has lived under bridges and in box culverts for as long as she can remember. The boys protect her, and in return she keeps them satisfied. She's now 19, and there's no way she will see 25, not on this side of the bars. She's covered in tattoos, and by the time she's sworn in, the jurors are already disgusted. She remembers that particular Wednesday, remembers the cops coming out to the pit, remembers Gardy being there all afternoon. On cross, Hoover can't wait to bring up the fact that she's been busted twice for shoplifting. For food! What are you supposed to do when you're hungry? Hoover makes this sound like she deserves the death penalty. We plow ahead. I call my alibi witnesses, who tell the truth, and Hoover makes them look like criminals. Such is the lunacy and unfairness of the system. Hoover's witnesses, the ones testifying on behalf of the state, are cloaked with legitimacy, as if they've been sanctified by the authorities. Cops, experts, even snitches who've been washed and cleansed and spruced up in nice clothes, all take the stand and tell lies in a coordinated effort to have my client executed. But the witnesses who know the truth and are telling it are discounted immediately and made to look like fools. Like so many, this trial is not about the truth. It's about winning. And to win with no real evidence, Hoover must fabricate and lie and attack the truth as if he hates it. I have 6 witnesses who swear my client was nowhere close to the scene when the crime was committed, and all 6 are scoffed at. Hoover has produced almost 2 dozen witnesses, virtually all known to be liars by the cops, the prosecution, and the judge, yet the jurors lap up their lies as if they're reading Holy Scripture. Chapter 13. I show the jurors a map of their lovely town. The pit is far away from the pond. There's no possible way Gardy could have been in both places at the approximate time the girls were murdered. The jurors don't believe any of this because they have known for some time that Gardy was a member of a satanic cult with a history of sexual perversion. There is no physical proof that the Fentress girls were sexually assaulted. Yet every miserable redneck in this awful place believes Gardy raped them before he killed them. At midnight, I'm lying across my lumpy motel bed, 9mm by my side, when my cell phone beeps. It's the DNA lab in San Diego. The blood Tadeo brutally extracted from the forehead of Jack Peely matches the strand of hair the murderer left behind in the shoelaces he tightly bound around the ankles of Jenna Fentress, age 11. Chapter 14. Sleep is impossible. I can't even close my eyes. Partner and I leave the motel in the dark and are almost to Milo before we see the first hint of light in the east. I meet with the bishop in his office as the town slowly comes to life. He calls Judge Kaufman at home, gets him up and out of bed, and at 8 a.m. I'm in his chambers with Hoover and the court reporter. All of what follows will be on the record. I lay out my options. If they refuse to stop the trial, dismiss the case, and send everybody home, and this is what I expect them to do, then I will either, 1, issue a subpoena for Jack Peely, have him hauled into court, put him on the stand, and expose him as the killer, or 2, go to the press with the details of the DNA testing, or 3, announce to the jury what I know, or 4, do all of the above, or 5, do nothing. Let them get their conviction and slaughter them on appeal. They demand to know how I obtained a blood sample for Jack Peely, but I'm not required to tell them. I remind them that for the past 10 months I've begged them to investigate Peely, to get a blood sample, and so on, but they have had no interest. They had Gardy, one of Satan's foot soldiers. For the 10th time, I explain that Peely, 1, knew the girls, 2, was seen near the pond when they disappeared, and 3, had just broken up with their mother after a long, violent romance. They are bewildered, stunned, at times almost incoherent, as reality settles in. Their bogus and corrupt prosecution has just unraveled. They have the wrong man. Virtually all prosecutors have the same genetic flaw. They cannot admit the obvious once it's on the table. They cling to their theories. They know they are right because they've been convinced of it for months, even years. "I believe in my case" is one of their favorite lines, and they'll repeat it mindlessly as the real killer walks forward with blood on his hands and says, "I did it." Because I've heard so much of their idiotic bullshit before, I have tried to imagine what Hoover might say at this point. But when he says, "It's possible Gardy Baker and Jack Peely were working together," I laugh out loud. Kaufman blurts, "Are you serious?" I say, "Brilliant, just brilliant. Two men who've never met, one 18 years old, the other 35, join up for about half an hour to murder two little girls, then go their separate ways, never to see each other again, and both determined to keep their mouths shut forever. You want to argue that on appeal?" "It wouldn't surprise me," Hoover says, scratching his chin as if his high-powered brain is clicking right along and sifting through new theories of the crime. Kaufman, whose mouth is still open in disbelief, says,
"You can't be serious, Dan."
Dan says,
"I want to proceed. I think Gardy Baker was involved in this crime. I can get a conviction."
It's pathetic to watch him plunge onward when he knows he's wrong. "Let me guess," I say.
"You believe in your case."
"Damned right I do. I want to go forward. I can get a conviction."
"Of course you can. And getting a conviction is far more important than justice," I say remarkably under control. "Get your conviction. We'll slog through the appellate courts for the next 10 years while Gardy wastes away on death row and the real killer walks the streets. Then one day, a federal judge somewhere will see the light and we'll have another high-profile exoneration. You, the prosecutor, and you, the judge, will look like idiots because of what's happening right now."
"I want to go forward," Hoover says, like a defective recording.
I keep going.
"I think I'll go to the press, show them the DNA test results. They'll splash it around, and you'll look like a couple of clowns still trying the case. Meanwhile, Jack Peely will disappear."
"How'd you get his DNA?" Judge Kaufman asks me.
He got in a bar fight last Saturday at the Blue and White, got his face busted, and the guy who did it works for me. I personally scraped Peely's blood off my guy's fist and sent it to the lab, along with the sample of the hair I collected earlier.
That's tampering with the evidence,
Hoover says predictably.
Oh, sue me, or throw me in jail again. This little party's over, Dan. Give it up.
Kaufman says,
I want to see the test results.
I'll have them by tomorrow. The lab's in San Diego.
We're in recess until then.
Chapter 15.
At some point during the day, the judge and the prosecutor meet secretly. I'm not invited. The rules of procedure prohibit such clandestine meetings, but they happen. These guys need an exit strategy, and fast. By now they know I'm half crazy, and I will indeed run to the press with my test results. At this desperate hour, they are still more concerned with politics than with the truth. All they care about is saving face. Partner and I return to the city, where I spend the day working on other cases. I convince the lab to email the test results to Judge Kaufman, and by noon he knows the truth. At 6 p.m., I get the phone call. Jack Peely has just been arrested. We meet the following morning in Kaufman's chambers, not in open court, where we belong. A dismissal in open court would be far too embarrassing for the system, so the judge and the prosecutor have conspired to do it behind closed doors, and as quickly as possible. I sit at a table with Gardy by my side and listen as Dan Hoover limps through a tepid motion to dismiss the charges. I strongly suspect that Hoover wants to proceed with his beloved case, the one he believes in so strongly. But Kaufman said no. Said this little party is over. Said, let's cut our losses and get this radical bastard and his brain-damaged client out of here. When the paperwork is signed, Gardy is a free man. He spent the last year in a tough jail. I should know. But a year in jail for an innocent man is pure luck in our system. There are thousands locked away for decades. But that's another soapbox. Gardy is bewildered, not sure where to go or what to do. As they lead us out of Kaufman's chambers, I hand him two $20 bills and tell him good luck. They'll sneak him back to the jail to collect his assets, and from there his mother will take him somewhere safe. I'll never see him again. He doesn't say thanks because he doesn't know what to say. I don't want to embrace him because he didn't shower last night, but we manage a quick hug in a narrow hallway while two deputies watch us. It's over, Gardy, I keep saying, but he doesn't believe me. Word has leaked, and there's a mob waiting outside. The town of Milo will never believe anyone but Gardy killed the Fentress girls, regardless of the evidence. This is what happens when the cops act on one of their smart hunches and march off in the wrong direction, controlling the rumors and taking the press along with them. The prosecutor joins the parade early on, and before long it becomes an organized and semi-legitimate lynching. I slip through a side door to where Partner is waiting. We make our escape, without an escort of any sort, and as we speed away from the courthouse, two tomatoes and an egg splash onto our windshield. I can't help but laugh. Once again, I'm leaving town in style.
Part 2. The Boom Boom Room.
Chapter 1. Rich people tend to avoid death row. Link Scanlon has not been so lucky, though you couldn't find three people in this city who care about Link or his luck. There are about 1 million people here, and when Link was finally convicted and sent away, virtually everyone felt some measure of relief. Drug trafficking was dealt a severe blow, though it soon recovered. Several strip clubs closed, which pleased many young wives. Parents of teenage girls told themselves their daughters were safer. Owners of fancy sports cars relaxed as auto thefts plummeted. Most important, the police and narcotics agents relaxed and waited for the dip in crime. It happened, but didn't last long. Link was sentenced to death by an untampered jury for killing a judge. Soon after he arrived on death row, his lead defense lawyer was found strangled. So I suppose the city's bar association was also relieved to see Link put away.
On second thought, there must have been several hundred people here who truly missed Link, at first. Morticians, strippers, drug runners, chop shop operators, and crooked cops, to name a few. But it doesn't matter now. That was 6 years ago, and once in prison, Link proved capable of running most of his businesses from behind bars. All he ever wanted was to be a gangster, an old-style, Capone-like character with a lust for blood and violence and unlimited cash. His father had been a bootlegger who died of cirrhosis. His mother had remarried often and badly. Unrestrained by a normal family life, Link hit the streets at the age of 12 and soon mastered petty thievery. By 15, he had his own gang and was selling pot and porn in our high schools. He was arrested at 16, got a slap on the wrist, and thus began a long and colorful relationship with the criminal justice system. Until he was 20, his name was George. It didn't fit, so he adopted and discarded several nicknames, jewels such as Lash and Boss. He finally settled on Link because he, George Scanlon, was so often linked to various crimes. Link fit him nicely, and he hired a lawyer to make it legal. Just Link Scanlon, no middle initial, nothing stuck on the end. The new name gave him a new identity. He was a new man with something to prove. He became reckless in his desire to become the toughest mobster in town, and he was quite successful. By the time he was 30, Link's thugs were killing regularly as he took over the city's skin business and cornered his share of the drug traffic. He has been on death row for only 6 years, and his execution is scheduled for 10 tonight. 6 years is not long on death row. On the average, at least in this state, the appeals drag on for 14 years before an execution. 20 is not unusual. The shortest was 2 years, but that guy begged for the needle. It's fair to say Link's case has been rushed along, or expedited. Kill a judge and all the other judges take offense. His appeals were met with surprisingly few delays. His conviction was affirmed, affirmed, and reaffirmed. All rulings were unanimous, not a single dissent anywhere, state or federal. The U.S. Supremes refused to consider his case. Link pissed off those who truly run the system, and tonight, the system gets the ultimate revenge. Judge Nagy was the one Link killed. He, Link, didn't actually pull the trigger. Instead, he sent word down the line that he wanted Nagy dead. A career hitter called Knuckles got the assignment and carried things out in splendid fashion. They found Judge Nagy and his wife in bed in their pajamas, bullet holes in their heads. Knuckles then talked too much, and the cops had a wire in the right place. Knuckles was on death row, too, for about 2 years, until they found him with Drano packed in his mouth and throat. The cops quizzed Link, but he swore he didn't know a thing about it. What was Judge Nagy's offense? He was a tough law and order type who hated drugs and was famous for throwing the book at traffickers. He was about to sentence two of Link's favorite henchmen, one was his cousin, to 100 years each, and this upset Link. It was his town, not Nagy's. He, Link, had been wanting to knock off a judge for years, sort of the ultimate takedown. Kill a judge, walk away from it, and the world knows you are indeed above the law. After his defense lawyer was murdered, folks thought I was a fool to take his case. Another bad outcome for Link, and they might find me at the bottom of a lake. But that was 6 years ago, and Link and I have gotten along just fine. He knows I've tried to save his life. He'll spare mine. What would he gain by killing his last lawyer? Chapter 2. Partner and I pull into the main gate at Big Wheeler, the maximum security prison where the state maintains its death row and does its executing. A guard steps to the passenger door and says, "Name?" "Rudd, Sebastian Rudd, here to see Link Scanlon."
"Of course."
The guard's name is Harvey, and we've chatted before, but not tonight. Tonight, Big Wheeler is locked down and there is a thrill in the air. It's execution time! Across the road, some protesters with candles sing a solemn hymn, while others chant support for the death penalty. Back and forth. There are TV news vans lining the highway. Harvey scribbles something on a clipboard, says, "Unit 9. And as we're about to drive away, he leans in and whispers,
"What are your chances?"
"Slim," I say, as we begin moving. We follow a prison security truck with gunmen standing in the back. Another one trails us. Floodlights nearly blind us as we inch along, passing brightly lit buildings where 3,000 men are locked in their cells and waiting for Link to die so things can return to normal. There is no sensible reason for a prison to go nuts when there's an execution. Extra security is never needed. No one has ever escaped from death row. The condemned men there live in isolation, and thus do not have a gang of friends who might decide to storm the Bastille and free everyone. But rituals are important to the men who run prisons, and nothing gets their adrenaline pumping like an execution. Their little lives are mundane and monotonous, but occasionally the world tunes in when it's time to kill a killer. No effort at heightened drama is to be missed. Unit 9 is far away from the other units, with enough chain link and razor wire around it to stop Ike on the beaches of Normandy. We eventually reach a gate where a platoon of jumpy guards can't wait to search Partner and me and our briefcases. These boys are far too excited about the evening's festivities. With escorts, we enter the building, and I'm led to a makeshift office where Warden McDuff is waiting, chewing his fingernails, obviously wired. When we're alone in a room with no windows, he says,
"Have you heard?"
"Heard what?"
10 minutes ago, a bomb went off in the old courthouse. Same courtroom Link got convicted in.
I've been in that courtroom 100 times, so, yes, I am shocked to hear it's been bombed. On the other hand, I'm not at all surprised to discover that Link Scanlan does not intend to go quietly.
"Anybody hurt?" I ask.
"Don't think so. The courthouse had just closed."
"Wow."
"Wow's right. You better talk to him, Rudd, and quick." I shrug and give the warden a hopeless look. Trying to talk sense to a gangster like Link Scanlan is a waste of time.
"I'm just his lawyer," I say.
"What if he hurts somebody?"
"Come on, warden. The state's executing him in a few hours. What else can it do to him?"
"I know, I know." "Where are the appeals?" he asks, crunching a sliver of thumbnail between his front teeth. He's about to jump out of his skin.
15th Circuit, I say. "A Hail Mary. They're all Hail Marys at this point, warden."
"Where's Link?"
"In the holding room. I got to get back to my office and talk to the governor.
Tell him I said hello. Tell him he still hasn't ruled on my last request for a reprieve."
"I'll do that," the warden says as he's leaving the room.
"Thanks." Few people in this state love an execution as much as our handsome governor. His routine is to wait until the last possible moment, then appear somberly in front of the cameras and announce to the world that he cannot, in good conscience, grant a reprieve. On the verge of tears, he'll talk about the victim and declare that justice must be done. I follow two guards dressed in full military gear through a maze and come to the boom boom room. It's nothing more than a large holding cell where the condemned is placed precisely 5 hours before his big moment. There, he waits with his lawyer, spiritual advisor, and maybe some family. Full contact is allowed, and there can be some pretty sad moments when Mama arrives for the final hug. The last meal is served precisely 2 hours before the final walk, and after that, only the lawyer can hang around. In decades past, our state used a firing squad. Cuffed and bound, the condemned was strapped to a chair, a black veil was dropped over his head, and a bright red cross was attached to his shirt, over his heart. 50 feet away, 5 volunteers waited behind a curtain with high-powered rifles, though only 4 were loaded. The theory was that none of the 5 would ever know for sure that he killed a man, and this was somehow supposed to assuage his guilt later in life, in the event that he had a change of heart and became burdened. What a crock! There was a long list of volunteers, all eager to put a bullet dead center in another man's heart. Anyway, prison lingo is vibrant and creative, and over time the execution room picked up its nickname. Legend has it that an air vent was intentionally left open so the cracking sound of the rifles echoed over the prison. When we adopted the needle, for humane reasons, less space was needed. Death Row was reconfigured. Walls were added here and there. Supposedly, the current Boom Boom Room includes the very spot where the condemned men sat and waited for the bullets. They frisk me again, and I walk through the door. Link is alone, sitting in a folding chair that is leaning against a cinder block wall. The lights are low. He's glued to a small, muted television screen hanging in a corner, and he does not acknowledge my arrival. His favorite movie is The Godfather. He's watched it 100 times, and years ago began working on his imitation of Marlon Brando. Scratchy, painful voice, one he blames on smoking. Clenched jaw, slow delivery, aloof, completely devoid of emotion. Our death row has a unique rule that allows the condemned man to die in any clothing he chooses. It's a ridiculous rule because, after living here for 10, 15, or 20 years, these guys have nothing in the way of a wardrobe. Standard-issue coveralls, maybe a pair of frayed khakis and a t-shirt to wear during visitation. Sandals, thick socks for the winter. Link, though, has money and wants to be buried in solid black. He's wearing a black linen shirt with long sleeves buttoned at the wrists, black denim jeans, black socks, and black running shoes. It's not nearly as stylish as he thinks, but at this point, who cares about fashion? Finally, he says,
"I thought you were going to save me."
"I never said that, Link. I even put it in writing."
"But I paid you all that money."
"A fat fee is no guarantee of a good outcome. That's in writing, too."
"Lawyers," he grunts in disgust,
"and I don't take this lightly. I have never forgotten what happened to his last one." He slowly leans forward, tipping his chair onto all fours, and stands up. Link is 50 now, and for most of his time on the row, he's managed to maintain his good looks. But he's aging quickly, though I doubt if anyone with a firm execution date worries too much about wrinkles and gray hair. He takes a few steps and turns off the television. The room is maybe 15 by 15, with a small desk, 3 folding chairs, and a cheap army-style cot, just in case the condemned might want to catch a few winks before being sent to his eternal rest. I was here once before, 3 years ago, when my client came within 30 minutes of getting the needle before we were handed a miracle by the 15th Circuit. Link will not be so lucky. He sits on a corner of the desk and looks down at me. He grunts and says,
"I trusted you."
"And with good reason, Link. I fought like hell for you."
"But I'm insane, legally, and you haven't convinced anyone of it. Crazy as hell. Why can't you make them see this?"
"I have tried, and you know it, Link. No one listened because no one wanted to listen. You killed the wrong person, a judge. Kill a judge, and his brethren take offense."
"I didn't kill him."
"Well, the jury said you did. That's all that matters." "We've had this conversation 1,000 times, and why not have it again? Right now, with less than 5 hours to go, I'll chat with Link on any subject."
"I'm insane, Sebastian. My mind is gone."
It is often said that everyone goes crazy on death row. 23 hours a day in isolation breaks a man mentally, physically, and emotionally. Link, though, has not exactly suffered like the rest. Years ago, I explained to him that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a state cannot execute a person who is either mentally retarded or who becomes mentally unsound. Soon thereafter, Link decided he should go insane, and he's been acting so ever since. The warden at that time agreed to move Link to the psych unit, where he enjoyed a much more comfortable lockup. Link lived there for 3 years before a journalist dug deep enough to discover a money trail between various members of the warden's immediate family and a certain crime syndicate. The warden quickly retired and dodged an indictment. Link got slammed back to death row, where he stayed for about a month before getting moved to PC, protective custody. There he had a larger cell and more privileges. The guards gave him anything he wanted because Link's boys on the outside were taking care of the guards with cash and drugs. In time, Link manipulated a transfer back to the psych unit. In his 6 years at Big Wheeler, he spent about 12 months locked up with the other killers on death row. I say, "The warden just told me the courthouse got bombed this afternoon. Same courtroom where you got convicted. What a coincidence, huh?" He frowns and offers a casual, Brando-like shrug, revealing nothing.
"I got an appeal floating somewhere right now," he says.
"It's at the 15th Circuit, but don't get excited."
"Are you telling me I'm going to die, Sebastian?"
"I told you that last week, Link. The fix is in. The last-minute appeals are worthless. Everything's been litigated, every issue covered. There's little we can do right now but wait and hope for a miracle."
"I should have hired that radical Jew lawyer. What's his name? Lowenstein?"
"Maybe, but you didn't. He's had 3 clients executed in the past 4 years. Mark Lowenstein is an acquaintance of mine and a fine lawyer. Between the two of us, we handle most of the untouchable cases in our end of the state. My cell phone vibrates. It's a text message. The 15th Circuit has just denied." I say, "Bad news, Link. The 15th just turned us down." He says nothing but reaches over and turns on the television. I turn the switch for more lighting and ask, "Is your son stopping by tonight?" He grunts,
"No."
He has 1 child, a son who just got out of federal prison. Extortion. He grew up in the family business and loves his old man, but no one can blame him for avoiding a prison, if only for a visit. Link says,
"We've said goodbye already."
"So, no guests tonight?" He grunts, says nothing. "No. No visitors for the last hug." Link was married 2 times, but hates both ex-wives. He hasn't spoken to his mother in 20 years. His only brother mysteriously disappeared after a bad business deal. Link reaches into his pocket, produces a cell phone, and makes a call. Inmate cell phones are violently forbidden, and they've caught Link with 12 over the years. The guards sneak them in. One who got caught said he was paid $1,000 in cash by a stranger in a Burger King parking lot after lunch. It's a quick call, I can't understand a word, and Link returns the phone to his pocket. Using the remote, he changes channels, and we watch a local cable news show. There's a lot of interest in his execution. A reporter does a nice job of recapping the Nagy murders. They flash photos of the judge and his wife, a pretty lady. I knew the judge well and appeared several times in his courtroom. He was a hard ass, but fair and smart. We were shocked when he was murdered, but not too surprised when the trail led to Link Scanlon. They run a clip of Knuckles, the gunman, as he's leaving court in handcuffs. What a nasty one. I say, "You know you're entitled to the counsel of a spiritual advisor." He grunts, "No." "The prison has a chaplain, if you'd like a word with him."
"What's a chaplain?"
"A man of God."
"And what might he say to me?"
"Oh, I don't know, Link. I'm told that some folks, right before they pass, like to get things right with God, confess their sins, stuff like that."
"That might take some time."
Contrition would be an inexcusable act of weakness for a mobster like Link. He has absolutely no remorse for the Nagy murders or for all those before them. He glares at me and says,
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm your lawyer. It's my job to be here, to make sure the final appeals run their course, to give advice."
"And your advice is to talk to a chaplain?"
We're startled by a loud knock on the door. It opens immediately, and a man in a cheap suit strolls in, with 2 guards as escorts. He says, "Mr. Scanlon, I'm Jess Foreman, assistant warden."
"A real pleasure,"
Link says, without taking his eyes off the television. Foreman ignores me and says, "I have a list of all those who will witness the execution. There's nobody on your list, right?"
"Right."
"Are you sure?" Link ignores this. Foreman waits, then says, "What about your lawyer?" He looks at me. "I'll be there," I say. The lawyer is always invited to watch. "Anybody from Judge Nagy's family?" I ask. "Yep, all 3 of his children." Foreman places the list on the desk and leaves. As the door slams behind him, Link says,
"Here it is."
He lifts the remote. increases the volume. It's a breaking story. A bomb just exploded in the stately courthouse where the 15th Circuit does its work. The scene outside is frantic as police and firemen scurry about. Smoke boils from a second-floor window. A breathless reporter is moving along the street with his cameraman in tow, looking for a better angle, and gushing on about what's happening. Link's eyes glow as he watches. I say, "Wow, another coincidence." But Link does not hear me. I try to act cool, calm, as if this is no big deal. A bomb here, a bomb there. A couple of phone calls from death row, and the fuses get lit. But I am astonished. Who might be next? Another judge? Perhaps the one who presided over his trial and sentenced him to death? That was Judge Cohn, since retired, and for about 2 years, during and after the trial, he had armed protection. Perhaps the jurors? They lived cautiously thereafter with the cops close by. No one was hurt or threatened. Link grunts.
Where does the appeal go now?
I guess he plans to bomb every courthouse from here to Washington. He knows the answer to his question. We've discussed it enough. I reply, the Supreme's in D.C. Why do you ask? He ignores this. We watch the television for a while. CNN picks up the story and, in its usual hysterical fashion, soon has us on red alert, as if jihadists were invading. Link is smiling. Half an hour later, the warden is back, fidgeting more than ever. He pulls me out of the room and hisses,
"You've heard about the 15th Circuit?
We're watching it.
You gotta stop him."
"Who?"
"Don't who me, dammit. You know what I'm talking about."
"We're not in control here, warden. The courts run their own schedules. Link's boys have their orders, evidently. Besides, the bombings might be coincidental."
"Yeah, right. The FBI is on the way here right now."
"Oh, that's real good, real smart. My client gets the needle in exactly 3 hours and 14 minutes, yet the FBI wants to grill him about these bombings. He's a seasoned thug, warden, a gangster from the old school, battle-hardened. He'll spit on any FBI agent within 20 feet. He looks like he's about to faint.
"We gotta do something," he says, wild-eyed. "The governor's yelling at me. Everybody's yelling at me."
"Well, it's up to the gov, if you ask me. He grants the reprieve, and I suppose Link stops the bombing campaign. Not sure, though, because he's not listening to me."
"Can you ask him?"
I laugh out loud. "Sure, warden. I'll just have a little heart-to-heart with my client, get him to confess, and convince him to stop whatever he'll admit to doing. No problem." He's too ashen to strike back, so he leaves, shaking his head, chewing his nails. Another bureaucrat, thoroughly overwhelmed with decision-making. I step back into the room and take a chair. Link is glued to the television. "That was the warden," I say. "And they'd really appreciate it if you'd call off the dogs." No response, no acknowledgement. CNN finally connects the dots, and suddenly my client is the hour's hottest story. They flash a mugshot of Link, a much younger version, as they interview the prosecutor who sent him away. From across the desk, Link curses under his breath, though he's still smiling. None of my business, but if I were inclined to plant bombs, this guy's office would be at the top of my list. His name is Max Mancini, the city's chief prosecutor and a true legend in his own mind. He's been popping off in the press all week as the countdown grew louder. Link will be his first execution, and he wouldn't miss it for anything. Frankly, I've never understood why Link chose to rub out his own defense lawyer instead of going after Mancini. But I won't ask. Evidently, Link and I are on the same page. Just as the reporter is wrapping up the interview, there is a loud noise somewhere in the background, behind Mancini. The camera pulls back, and it's clear to me that they're standing on the sidewalk outside his downtown office. Another explosion. Chapter 3. The courtroom was bombed at precisely 5 p.m. The 15th Circuit, precisely at 6. The prosecutor's office, precisely at 7. As we approach 8 p.m., many people who've had the misfortune of crossing paths with my client are nervous. CNN, now in full unbridled frenzy, is reporting that security has been beefed up around the Supreme Court building in Washington. Their reporter on the scene keeps showing us a few offices with lights on, and we're supposed to believe the justices are up there, hard at work, debating the merits of Link's case. They are not. They're all safely at home or at dinner. One of their clerks will deny our petition any minute now. The governor's mansion is crawling with state police, some armed from head to toe in full combat regalia, as if Link might decide to mount a ground assault. With so many cameras around, so much drama everywhere, our handsome governor couldn't help himself. 10 minutes ago, he dashed out from his bunker to chat with the reporters, live, of course. Said he wasn't frightened. Justice must go on. He'd do his job without fear, etc. ad nauseam. He tried to act as though he's really wrestling with the reprieve issue, so he's not ready to announce his decision. He'll save it for later, say around 9:55. He hasn't had this much fun in years. I'm tempted to ask Link, who's next? But let it pass. We're playing gin rummy as the clock ticks and Rome burns. He's told me several times I could leave, but I'm hanging around. I won't admit that I'm keen to watch his execution, but I am fascinated by it. No one has been hurt. The three bombs were mainly gasoline, according to some so-called expert CNN dragged in for authenticity. Low-tech time bombs, probably in small packages, designed to make a little noise and a lot of smoke. At 8 p.m., everyone takes a deep breath. All's quiet for the moment. They knock on the door and wheel in the last meal. For the occasion, Link has chosen a steak with fries and coconut pie for dessert. But he has no appetite. He takes 2 bites of the steak and offers me the fries. I say no thanks and shuffle the deck. There's something about eating another man's last meal that doesn't seem right. At 8:15, my cell phone vibrates. Our petition has been denied at the Supreme Court. No surprise there. There's nothing left. All Hail Marys have been thrown and dropped. We go live, outside the Supreme Court building in Washington, where the CNN reporter is practically praying for some type of explosion. Dozens of cops loiter about, their trigger fingers just itching. A small crowd has gathered to watch the carnage, but there's nothing. Link keeps one eye on the television as he deals the cards. I suspect he's not finished. Chapter 4. The prison has a food storage warehouse on the west side of its vast complex and a vehicle maintenance facility on the east side. The buildings are about 3 miles apart. At 8:30, both mysteriously catch on fire and the prison goes berserk. Evidently, there are a couple of news helicopters in the area. They are not allowed to fly over Big Wheeler, so they're hovering above farmland next door, and thanks to their long-range lenses, we're able to watch the excitement courtesy of CNN. As Link toys with his coconut pie and plays gin rummy, the anchor wonders why the state doesn't speed up his execution before he burns down the prison. A stuttering spokesperson with the governor's office tries to explain that the rules and laws do not allow this. It's 10 p.m., period, or as soon thereafter as possible. Link watches this as if it's a movie about some other guy on death row. At 8:45, a bomb goes off in the administration building, not far from the warden's office. 10 minutes later, the warden bursts into the boom-boom room and screams, "You've got to stop this!" Link ignores him as he shuffles the cards. 2 nervous guards grab Link, lift him up, search him, find his cell phone, then throw him back into his chair. His face does not change expression. "You got a phone, Rudd?" the warden yells at me. "Yes, but you can't have it. Rule 36, Section 2, Paragraph 4. Your rule. Sorry." "You son of a bitch! So you think I'm making phone calls to the bad guys? You think I'm part of the conspiracy, with all my calls being traced? That right, warden?" He is too panic-stricken to respond. From behind the warden, a guard yells into the room, "There's a riot in Unit 6! Chapter 5. The riot started when an inmate, an old lifer with a history of heart problems, faked cardiac arrest. At first, the guards decided to ignore him and let him go, but on second thought, they got involved. His cellmate stabbed two guards with a shank, grabbed their tasers, fried them, then beat them senseless. The inmates quickly put on the guards' uniforms and managed to open the doors to about 100 cells. With near flawless coordination, the inmates flooded other wings in the unit, and soon several hundred extremely dangerous convicts were on the loose. They began burning mattresses, laundry, anything that could possibly be ignited. Eight guards were beaten. Two would later die. Three guards with pistols hid in an office and called for help. Before long, the inmates found weapons and gunfire could be heard across the prison. In the melee, four snitches were hanged with electrical extension cords. We wouldn't know these details until later, so at the time, Link and I casually play cards while Big Wheeler explodes around us. It takes CNN less than 5 minutes to pick up the riot story, and when we hear it, we stop and watch the television. After a few minutes, I say, "So, Link, are you in charge of prison riots, too?" To my surprise, he says,
"Yes, at this moment, anyway."
"Oh, really? Then tell me how this one started."
"It all goes back to personnel," he says, like a polished CEO. "You gotta have the right people in the right place at the right time. You got three guys in Unit 6 doing life with no parole, so they got nothing to lose. You set up an outside contact who promises all sorts of stuff, like a van and a driver waiting in the woods if the guys make it out, and lots of cash. You give them plenty of time to plan it all. And at exactly 9 on this night, when the warden and his goons are thinking of only one thing, giving me the needle, you launch your assault. Unit 4 should blow up any minute."
"I won't tell a soul."
"And the bombs?
Who rigged the bombs?"
"Can't give you the names. You gotta understand prisons and how stupid the men are who run them. Everything here is designed to keep us in, with little thought to keeping bad stuff out. Those incendiary devices were planted 2 days ago, well hidden. They've got timers and all, really basic stuff. No one was looking. Piece of cake."
It's a relief to hear him talking like this. I suppose his nerves are starting to jump, though he looks as calm as ever. "What's the endgame tonight, Link? Are these guys going to attack Death Row and rescue you?"
"Wouldn't work. Too many guns around here. Just having some fun, that's all. I'm at peace."
As he says this, they flash another image of the prison burning, another camera shot from a helicopter nearby. We're too deep in the building to hear anything, but it looks like total chaos. Buildings on fire, a million red and blue lights flashing, an occasional gunshot. Link can't help but smile. "Just fun and games."
"It's the warden's own stupid fault," he says. "Why all the pomp and ceremony just for an execution? He brings in every available guard, gives them automatic weapons and Kevlar vests, as if someone, me, the guy getting the needle, might somehow put together an offensive. Goons everywhere. Then he turns on all the lights and locks down the entire prison. Why, exactly? No good reason. Hell, two guards without guns could just as easily walk me down the hall at the appointed hour and strap me onto the table. No big deal. No cause for all this drama. But no, the warden likes his rituals. It's a big moment for law enforcement, and hell, they gotta make the most out of it. What any fool can see, anyone but the warden, is that he's dealing with men who live in cages and who hate anybody in a uniform. They're already looking for trouble, so you crank up the pressure on them, and they blow a gasket. Just take someone like me to facilitate things."
He sips a cherry cola and nibbles a French fry. He's got 40 minutes. The door opens again, and Assistant Warden Foreman is back, now with 3 heavily armed warriors. Foreman says,
"How you guys doing in here?"
"Swell," I say. Nothing from Link. I say, "Looks like you boys got your hands full out there." He says,
"Things are hopping. Just wanted to check on the prisoner and make sure everything is okay."
Link glares at him and says,
"This is my last hour. Why can't I have some peace and quiet? Please, you and your goons, just get the hell out of here, okay?"
We can accommodate you, Foreman says.
And take him too, Link says, pointing at me. I need to be alone.
Foreman says, Well, sorry, Link, but there's no place for Mr. Rudd to go. The roads are blocked right now. We're in super lockdown. It's not safe out there.
And for some reason, I don't feel so safe in here,
Link sneers.
Can't imagine why.
Looks like we should postpone the execution, I say. Probably not going to happen, Foreman says, backing away. They leave, slamming the door and locking it from the outside. The governor feels the need to address his people. On the screen, we see his troubled face. He's at a podium with mics and cameras before him, a politician's dream. Random questions are hurled at him, and we soon learn that the situation at Big Wheeler is tense. There are casualties, even deaths. There are about 200 inmates out of their cells, though none have yet to penetrate the exterior fences of the prison. Several fires are now under control. Yes, it seems as though some of this activity was coordinated from outside the prison, and no, there is no evidence that Link Scanlon is behind it. Not yet, anyway. He, the governor, has called in the National Guard, though the state police have things under control. And oh, by the way, he is denying the final request for a reprieve. Chapter 6 Protocol requires that the condemned man be handcuffed at 9:45 and escorted for his final walk to the death room.